The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents an author meets critics session, number 331, applying new organizational theories to the LDS Church. Fun ideas from Meg Wheatley's Leadership and the New Science, learning about organization from an orderly universe.
Come on up. Give some space to the person that's sitting. My name is Derek Larson. I'd like to welcome you to this session of Sunstone Symposium. This particular session, I think, has got the longest title in the whole symposium. Applying New Organizational Theories to the LDS Church, Fun Ideas from Meg Wheatley's Leadership and the New Science, Learning About Organization from an Orderly Universe. And as I came in this morning, I thought, gosh, they've put us on the edge of the edge, you know. We're out here on the edge of Sunstone, and so I think that there's a reason for that, and I think that you'll find out as we have a chance for the next hour and a half to discuss the ideas and principles in Meg's. If you haven't seen this book, many of you are here probably because you've read this book, and if you haven't read this book, this is the book, and it's been out for 2 years now. It was released 2 years ago in the fall, 1992, and we've got a panel discussion. I don't think so. I was going to call last night and see if we could get some copies of it. Sam Weller's Desert Book, probably B. Dalton, A Woman's Place, bookstore, isn't it? I might mention that this book received the Management Book of the Year Award from Industry Week magazine in 1992, when it came out. And as the panelists will share with you, it has had wide exposure, and it was written, I don't know for sure, but it's listed as a business book, and the principles of it are focused towards nonprofit and profit organizations, corporations. However, it has much far-reaching effect on individuals and the way we order our own individuality, I should say. And so I think that we'll enjoy this session. I'm going to read a little bit about the book, and then I'm going to introduce the panelists. Leadership and the New Science. Each of us lives and works in organizations designed from Newtonian images of the universe, Margaret Wheatley writes in this groundbreaking book. Our assumptions come to us from 17th century physics, from Newtonian mechanics, but the science has changed. If we are to continue to draw from the sciences to create and manage organizations, then we need to at least ground our work in the science of our times. We need to stop seeking after the universe of the 17th century and begin to explore what has become known to us in the 20th century. Wheatley takes the reader on a mind-opening journey into the new science. The revolutionary discoveries in quantum physics, chaos theory, and molecular biology that are changing our understanding of the universe. And she applies these scientific concepts to offer new light on the fundamental issues of organizing work, people, and life, including, how can we find order in a chaotic world? How is order different than control? How can we create more participative, open, and adaptive organizations? How can we reconcile individual autonomy and organizational control? What leads to organizational growth and self-renewal instead of decline and death? And so those are some of the questions that are posed at the beginning of this book, and also many other questions. As each individual reads and ponders this book, I think a lot of other questions remain to be asked. And I might mention that this particular subject is reaching into all sectors of life, whether it's science, academics, business, religion. And I've thought a lot about this book and how, wondering how it fits in the context of quote unquote the church. And obviously things kind of gravitate into the church from organizational theory, motivational theory, leadership, and any other theory that we have. I'm talking about leadership and the new science. And so it has far-reaching effects. I've heard it talked about in the symposium this year already. Scott Barchi talked about the effects of new science and participative democratic leadership. And so without any further discussion by my part, let me introduce the panelists. We'll first hear from Stan Christensen. To my left, Stan received his education at BYU and Harvard University. Stan is currently a consultant, recently transplanted from the Boston area out to Salt Lake area. And Stan works with the Harvard Negotiation Project, which he informs me he was introduced to Meg's book a couple years ago when it came out. And so we'll hear from him first. He'll be followed by Pamela Bradshaw. Pam is an educational consultant. She received her education, her master's degree from Utah State University. And she, I happened to meet her just about 6 weeks ago, I guess, and I was talking to Aaron Silva about some of the principles in this book, and Pam heard me and talked about how it had affected her. She is preparing an article, an interview with Meg on some of the principles in the book, and she's going to be our second panelist. And after they're finished, we'll hear from Meg. And Meg is a former professor of management and ethics at Brigham Young University. She's also a transplant from the East and received her education at Harvard. Meg is the president of the Vercana Institute. She also has her own consulting firm, KRW and Associates, where she travels and speaks. And on occasion, she tells me that she gets chances to write if she can find the quiet time to be able to do that. And I might mention the Vercana Institute, of which Meg is one of the founding principals of this, is a nonprofit organization that was created to explore the ideas of the new science in the process of helping to create the theory and the framework for the organizations of the 21st century. And so I've been able to participate in one of those dialogues. And what happens, basically, is people are drawn in from all over the country and all over the world, literally, people from other countries, and come in, and in a process-oriented atmosphere, there's a dialogue that takes place about what we want to create and how we bring our own realities into that process of creation. And so this Vercana provides this kind of an outlet, and I find it very, very useful. Not to say that it takes place at Sundance, which provides a very nice atmosphere for it. So we'll go ahead and turn the time over. After Meg is finished, we'll have some time for hopefully a little dialogue amongst ourselves about these principles. And so I'll turn the time over to Stan.
A couple of years ago, I was in a stake meeting, and it was like a lot of stake meetings. There were a lot of people sitting around the table. And we had a particularly orthodox stake president and a somewhat less orthodox bishop. And they had a sort of classic balance of power issue. They were sort of always going back and forth on issues. In this particular meeting, the stake president said to the bishop in somewhat of an accusatory tone, he said, "Bishop, I hear your ward is becoming a haven for homosexuals." And all of us got quite tense around the table, and we weren't surprised by the comment, but we were interested to what the reply would be. And the bishop, without pausing a minute, said, "Well, that's great news, because I would hope that my ward, the ward that I'm serving, would become a haven for any group that's disenfranchised and needing to feel the love of Christ." And I remember that at the time, I was reading Fritjof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics. I was unsuccessfully dating a woman who was a physics PhD student and trying to speak her language. And like Meg's book, talks about new developments in science. And I remember thinking about, in this specific interaction between the bishop and the stake president, that the bishop seemed to really have the ideas of participation and inclusion and relationship, more of the sort of new approaches to science in mind, and the sort of more orthodox, traditional stake president seemed to be working more on metaphors that would be thought of as traditional scientific metaphors, things like measurement and reduction and categorizations and control. And I've sort of stayed involved in that field, although didn't stay involved with that particular woman, and have been interested over the years, and was grateful when Meg's book came out and gave me some new things to think about. I think that the relationship between religion and politics and science is one that's extremely interesting. They tend to feed off each other, usually with religion following to a certain extent. Looking back at the sort of ancient Christianity, there was almost a complete marriage between religion and politics, and science was really subservient to the two. Then came Galileo, and he conducted his experiments of the Copernican notions of playing with pendulums and dropping balls, and it really sort of turned religion on its head in terms of its notions about explorations of science, and really introduced nature and reason and experience, and maybe most importantly, the importance of perceptions. There was, of course, as everybody knows, sort of a 100-year battle that ensued after that between science and religion, and the naturalist saying that experience offers the undisputable truth, and the traditional religionist saying that relying on perceptions, you really lose the connection with the divine. The science that tended to fall out of that was the traditional Newtonian or Cartesian notions, which lasted for about 300 years, looking at things like measurement and control and reduction being extremely important. And what I thought would be interesting here today is to look a little bit more at the 20th century and what some of the developments in politics and science are, and see what we can learn from religion, particularly as they apply to Meg's book. In the 20th century, politics, the sort of most observable changes in the political world have of course, been the two world wars. I think the formation of the nation state and then the sort of recent collapse of the nation state as an important entity, really the balkanization to some extent of the world. And I think that most of us would agree that the increase in rational knowledge really hasn't been so helpful at resolving conflicts on the political front worldwide. Scientific developments, as Meg points out, really have taken the development with Heisenberg, quantum physics, Einstein, relativity theory, and really in general the more participative nature of the universe seems to be what people spend most of their time talking about. Complexity theory certainly is a recent development. And in the religious front, if we look just at Christianity, we really seem to have, to some extent, the collapse of traditional Christianity. I think that the age of Christianity is largely threatened. I think that there is a real sort of fragmentation and secularization of Christianity. And a lot of that results, it seems, because of the fear of institutions, which seems to be quite pervasive throughout the world. Now, within Christianity, looking just at sort of the LDS Mormon religion, it's really quite the contrary of the collapse that's going on with most of Christianity. And Mormonism is actually quite a thriving religion if you sort of measure it by traditional notions of attendance and participation. But there are extreme challenges, and a lot of those have been talked about at the symposium that come with growth. So looking at some of the ideas that Meg developed, I'd just like to look at sort of three or four of them and see what we might learn as a church from some of those developments. The first one is this notion of measurement and reduction being a traditional scientific notion, and the new notion being that how things relate to each other is extremely important. And, of course, the old science did concentrate more on the reduction in measurement. The new science as Meg points out, brings out the point that measurement itself causes inaccuracies, and the measurement causes really distortions of reality. Measurement is often the wrong focus, although important, and that nothing exists really independent of relationships in science. We are all different in different situations. The sort of importance of the place of the observer that she brings out, I think, is a really important notion. Looking at the political front on this same topic, the old notion of balance of power seemed to be extremely important early on in the 20th century, influence being the result of force. I've been working in my professional life a lot over the last couple of months on the negotiations between North and South Korea. And it's a really interesting dynamic, and what you've got there is what the sort of American media and Americans tend to concentrate on is the sort of balance of power issues. Does North Korea have a nuclear weapon or nuclear weapons, and are they going to use them, and what would that do, and what can we do to prevent that? And they tend to have taken traditional notions of threatening, if you don't do X, we will do Y, and it has tended until about the last month or so to be very traditional balance of power politics. And as soon as a dialogue really ensued between the North, the South, and the U.S., they found that there's all sorts of things in common. The nuclear issue really hasn't been the focus of the talks that I've been involved in. It's been much more around what do we have in common, and it wasn't too hard to find out that really everybody wants the same thing for North Korea, including the North Koreans, which is some inclusion in the world. North Korea is literally a starving country, and what they want to do is be included. What South Korea wants to do is have them included. What we would like them to do is be included. And it was very easy to get to that once dialogue started, and the whole dynamic has changed since then. I think more generally in the world, trade being so important, unification being a real metaphor in politics. And really what I spend a lot of my time doing is sort of helping people, organizations, and countries look at alternatives to the traditional rule-based systems that are very parallel to traditional rule-based and measurement systems in science. And taking this discussion to the church and our church, I think that the focus on measurement and goals can really conflict with a focus on relationships, which is certainly one of the traditional focuses of Christianity. And it ends up, unfortunately, driving what we do in terms of our specific behaviors. If the focus on goals is always one that's a little bit troubling for me in the church. I sort of can't imagine that if Christ came tomorrow that he would be bearing his Franklin planner and have sort of 16 things to do. It's extremely hard to come up with how we measure relationships. We might think about more complex ways of doing that. I think that it's certainly the focus on measurement and goals leads to judgmental attitudes, and I think I've certainly in my life been guilty of that as a result of sort of participation, I think, in the organization. Whether it's church attendance or focus on a health code that we have or focus on going on a mission versus not going on a mission, these are very measurable activities. I remember when I was in college, I was having a discussion with a professor about church attendance and the importance of church attendance. And his line on it was, you should go to church every Sunday unless you have something better to do. And if you never have anything better to do than go to church on Sunday, then you're just not living the gospel. And that really has sort of have stuck with me. I can think of a lot of times that I've sort of carried out assignments because they were there and it was an assignment to be carried out. And the same metaphors could be carried through to the word of wisdom, the focus on that, which most of us would agree in general is a good code and a helpful code, but the over-focus on it can often be destructive. Missions, the same way. We concentrate on whether men or women go on missions instead of sort of how they serve their missions or what they do on their missions. It tends to be a thing that we sort of measure and check off. I think that the traditional notions of force and influence through force in the church often lead to coercion. You hear all the time notions of, because of my office, you should obey or you should follow my advice. I think in councils, certainly in priesthood councils that I've been involved in, there is tremendous, tremendous pressure to agree in council and to have unanimity. I think that often we end up using divinity in the church as a scapegoat. It certainly happens whenever there's a controversy. We sort of will reference a scripture or what a church leader might have said and use it as a scapegoat. I think in terms of social issues, marriage, having children, again, we tend to measure these things. I, as a single person, hear this at least once a week, sort of why I'm 31 and not married. And, you know, having babies, it's sort of the same thing. Why don't you have more babies being the focus and the measurable, observable data instead of sort of, you know, what kind of a spouse you are. I think that we could learn a lot from other churches in this area. I've always thought it was a very good idea that what lots of other churches do, which is send young couples that are going to be married through sort of education process and sort of what marriage is like. And the result of that people always joke about, but I think is true, is lots of people end up not getting married because of what they learn in those courses. And I think that often would be valuable in our church. I think that what we need to do as a church is to promote understanding, help sort of educate each other on how to work through and work out relationships and change the focus from measurement. The next idea I want to talk about a little bit that Meg brought up was the importance of subtlety and contextualizing things as opposed to polarizing things. Certainly the traditional notions of science being focused on big numbers, important trends, major variances, black and white, ones and zeros, tend to be sort of old science metaphors. New science tends to concentrate more on subtlety and relationships. Certainly in artificial intelligence, the idea of cumulative probability, which, you know, is sort of saying, look, it's not always ones and zeros or yeses or nos. The idea of fuzzy logic being really important to developments going on right now at the Media Lab in terms of AI. The notion that there really are shades of gray in everything. On the political front, looking at this idea, I think the old view of polarization and exclusion is seen most illustratively through race and ethnic racial and ethnic conflicts. I think that often we want an enemy, we want an extreme, we want to sort of have someone else to concentrate on, and there are obvious destructive things that come out of that. It makes it very hard to concentrate on subtlety and complexity. The conflicts in the paper, South Africa, Cyprus, India, the Middle East, all of these are conflicts that to some extent have resulted from polarization, labeling, and stereotypes. One that I've been involved in, been working for the last couple of years in Colombia, mediating between three different guerrilla groups and the government there. And sort of all you have to do is go to a cocktail party and say that you're working with guerrillas, and everybody gets really interested, and they sort of imagine Pancho Villa and people with big mustaches and bullets strapped across their chests. And in reality, guerrillas are people, like North Koreans, are people who have interests, and often they're extremely legitimate. And by sort of not labeling them and not stereotyping and not categorizing them and having a dialogue with them, you know, progress really, really can be made. I think taking this to the religious level, there's a real limitation to a model of black and white in a world that is certainly in our church increasingly diverse. I think at the local level, we do a pretty good job of concentrating on relationships. At the administrative level, it's a much larger challenge, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The sort of idea of worthiness measures being measurable and identifiable, when really lots of worthiness is probably a very individual and subtle thing, tends to be the wrong focus. It might be important, but it seems to be the wrong focus. I think not categorizing. In these kind of symposia, you hear a lot of talk about the certain categories, whether it be feminists or intellectuals or homosexuals or church leaders. I think that there's some real reverse categorization that goes on. I certainly feel it in terms of the brethren. It seems to be this group of people that gets lumped together. And from the little that I know about sort of workings amongst this group of people, there are a lot of differences and a lot of subtlety and a lot of contextualism that, you know, we as the members should probably consider when we're thinking about the leadership of the church. I think that there's a real need in our church for dialogue. That's one of the things I really enjoy about these kind of symposium, is the chance to talk about subtlety in issues. Not to emphasize, I think we would do a lot better if we didn't emphasize the proprietariness of whether it's our truth or our religion, but we sought for one of more inclusion and learned more from other religions. I think Meg's point about a sort of emphasis on process skills in the church would be extremely, extremely helpful. think that, you know, sort of starting that the focus in terms of organizational change at the church often, as I hear discussions, tends to be on the top and the top of the hierarchy. When I think that often we don't have as much control as we think we might at changing things from the top, but we have a lot of control or a lot of ability to persuade and influence sort of the younger age groups, and sort of education tends to be the way to do that. And I think that we can play a tremendous role. Working recently in the conflict in Cyprus, we've been mediating between the Greek Cypriots and the Turk Cypriots, and at the top it's extremely difficult, and in the schools it's extremely easy. The prejudices aren't as polar, and I think that we could learn a lot from that in the church, sort of where to focus our attention. The idea that Meg brings up of control being the old scientific metaphor versus participation, I think, is a useful one. And I mentioned complexity theory, the need for broad distribution of viewpoints and interactions. If we're going to live in a non-objective world, which I really think it is, we need to look at getting past single-mindedness and single interpretations of things and trying to factor out our biases. I think on the political front, we've seen that in the rise of democracy, most obviously in the Latin American countries where I've spent some time. The rise in ethnic conflict that's coming about because of the fall of the sort of nation state as the central focus, certainly seen that in the former Soviet Union and in the Baltics. Taking this to the level of religion, someone made the comment in a presentation that big-time religion needs big-time control. And again, that might be right, but the more interesting and more subtle question is how you control and how you manage the organization. It's not in either a sort of control or non-control. It's sort of how that happens, and that's the level that the discussion probably needs to be on. I think that in Mormonism, it's important that we have a prophetic voice and a prophet that leads the church, but often what happens as a result of that prophetic voice is the preclusion of any discussion, sort of the idea that sort of the thinking has been done that we hear so often. And again, I think it shouldn't be an either-or conversation. I think the prophet of the church as the president, sort of the leader of the administration as well as the leader of the spiritual and receiving the revelation, is a very confusing notion. The administrative concerns, I think, are much more participative by nature because they bring up difference issues and diversity issues, and they need to be dialogued. And often they get lumped in with the spiritual concerns of the church, and there are some good reasons to separate them out. I was extremely encouraged in the last general conference. Brother Ballard sort of gave a talk on the importance of participative management. Sort of set up a very structured sort of way of doing this, of consulting with people in the ward and solving lots of the problems of wards in councils as opposed to individuals, which I thought was extremely encouraging. Brother Maxwell, before he was called in his current calling, wrote a book that probably a lot of you have read called The More Excellent Way, which is, again, talks a lot about participation and inclusion, which is interesting. I think in the church that what we need is to provide the forum to disagree and to have conflicts, because I think a lot of learning comes out of that. The idea that disagreement is a sin and that we should all be of one mind, that we should avoid contention, is probably a mistaken notion, or at least the way that it gets translated in our church is a mistaken notion. I think of the story of President Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, when he was criticized for having lots of people in his cabinet that disagreed with him and came up with the sort of saying, you know, if there were more of them, I would put more of them in my cabinet, sort of wanting people that disagreed and having a balance of opinion. I remember when I was quite young listening to one of the general authorities say that we need to ask why more often in the church. We need not just to sort of take things for granted, and that's always really stuck with me. I think promoting that would be useful. The tension that comes with a lot of this is that in an increasingly pluralistic society, you still need a unified ideology. And the notion from Meg's book that I thought was really nice on this was that of self-renewing organisms that are able to sort of maintain their identity while changing form. In politics, the counterpart to this is, I think, the multicultural movement that is so important and pervasive in the world. The illustration that came to my mind was Canada and some of the problems they're having with multiculturalism. There's sort of a whole group in Canada that's saying, look, we should sort of get rid of hockey, we should get rid of maple syrup. The things that people traditionally think of as Canadian notions don't support multiculturalism, and that's probably going to the extreme, and we, I think, need to have an identity. The Amitai Etzioni, who sort of has borne the communitarian cross, and probably lots of you have read his book, Spirit of Community, I think speaks really well to this point, talking about the need for shared values, mutual respect, individual rights, as common sort of individual components of the North American culture. Looking at religion on this point, I think that sameness and homogeneity really are the road to institutional death. On the other hand, we can learn from other religions, most notably, I think, the Unitarians, who have a very loose structure and have a tremendous difficulty maintaining any kind of organization or identity because of their loose structure. And so there's a real tension, and what we need to do is have a discussion about where the balance is rather than polarizing. I think that sort of the idea that Chieki Okazawa has pushed of principles being important and practices needing to be flexible, I think is just an excellent way, and it really fits well into the Hindu tradition of followers being able to approach the divine in different ways. I think that we do need to be tolerant as a growing church and need to figure out what the appropriate role of sort of us as members and the administration is. I think that often the argument that comes up against this is the slippery slope. If we sort of change little things, then we're doomed. It's going to be a downward spiral. And often the Jewish religion is used as an example. As soon as they sort of opened up and reform came, they had a tremendous, tremendous difficult time getting the rest of the religion to maintain any kind of a commitment. And people, I've heard church leaders cite that as an example of what could happen if we compromise on things. And again, I think that's the wrong focus, the slippery slope argument. I think that, you know, if you are a young man or a young woman and you go out on a date before you're 16, that doesn't sort of mean you're on this downward spiral towards, you know, some terrible immoral problem. I think if you, you know, and these are just sort of the simple examples, but the little things that we might compromise on don't necessarily mean organizationally that the church is going down the tubes. I guess just in conclusion, I think that people in science are talking now a lot about grand unification theory. Certainly in physics, that seems to be a lot of discussion. And it's a sort of widening of the world of physics. I think in politics, people really are talking more about dialogue, relationships, inclusion, the old notions of sort of focusing against the Japanese, focusing against the Soviet Union are really going away as focuses. I think in religion, that we can learn a lot from this. I think we need to encourage dialogue. I think that we need to extend our borders while maintaining identity. I think that as members, we should take an active role in this and that we can learn a tremendous amount from other disciplines and hope that we will all participate in this endeavor. Thank you.
Wow. Gorillas. It's G-U-E-R.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, North and South Korea. I think as a classroom teacher, an elementary school teacher, kindergarten, first, second grade, I think as I stand before you, I stand by virtue of my non-credentials. Rather than my credentials, I'm just amazed. I want to talk to you more about North and South Korea. That's neat. While Stan was mediating differences between North and South Korea, I was in Cody, Wyoming 2 weeks ago, mediating between classroom teachers and special ed teachers. They both wanted to have an enemy too, you know. They were both there, but it's a little smaller scale maybe. Also, it's interesting that when this book was first placed in my hands, I had no background about corporations at all. I'd been a classroom teacher in public schools for 9 years. And Paul Swenson, my good friend who knows me pretty well, came to me and he said, "Pam, you need to read this book." And I went, "Oh, it looks pretty dry. Are you sure I need to read this book?" And he said, "Yeah, you need to read this book." So I looked through and there were some pretty pictures in there. But, see how pretty? But I thought, I just can't imagine what this book might have for me. until I started to read the first chapter, and then immediately I was taken. I'm just curious, how many people have not had a chance to read this book? Oh, great. Good. If my focus can have one place today, it's on the widespread appeal of this book. Meg talks about creating fields in her book, and one thing I really appreciate about it is that Meg was able to help me understand this form of science on a level that I didn't think I was going to be able to use, and I really did. In creating fields, I have created expectations. One of the expectations I have for myself is that I may be the very luckiest person I've ever encountered. I'm really lucky to have read this book. I'm really lucky to have had the chance to interview Meg for an article. And lucky just to be here. It's curious to me now that I am in a corporation. I work for Paramount Corporation right now as an educational consultant in conjunction with their multimedia publishing efforts. So I go from school to school to school and help teachers understand how they might be able to use the multimedia computer-assisted instruction that they've done. Now, curiously, being in this corporation as I am now, I've been able to look around and try to find the parts of corporate workings that I haven't seen before, how organizations are structured. And I pretty much decided that they didn't have a clue about this. I saw a lot of top-down management, a lot of decisions being made for me, focus on status quo, hoping to increase sales, you know, and keep things very safe. Well, I was in Oklahoma City last week, and as we were being prepped for the presentations that were going to happen the next day, Mona Autry, my consultant colleague from Oklahoma, had all our training materials there, and in our training materials was this piece of paper. And I looked through and I said, well, what's this? Oh, and she said, that's just for you. Let me read to you what this is. It says, the things we fear most in organizations, fluctuations, disturbances, imbalances, are the primary sources of creativity. And it's noted here, the author is Margaret J. Wheatley, Leadership in the New Science. And I went, wow, where did you find this? I can't believe you got this. And she said, oh, that was in Reader's Digest. And I just liked that, so I concluded that. Meg just now said, well, I'll let you say, but she said, I've hit the big time now. I'm in Reader's Digest. Also, when I was in Cody, I passed through Jackson, Wyoming, and I have here a copy of The Crone Chronicles. This is a journal of conscious aging. And as I look through this interesting magazine, I happen to know the person who puts this together, so I stopped and looked through it, and I was going to purchase a copy. And I'll be darned if we don't have Bringing the Goddess into the Boardroom here. Interview with Dr. Margaret Wheatley.
My only regret is I'm no longer BYU, because that kind of title, Bringing the Goddess, is fun.
Yeah. Well, I've mentioned before, Paul Swenson introduced me to this, and before, well, after I stepped down, I'd really love Paul to come up and read to you a poem that he wrote about the ideas in this. So we'll look forward to that. It's interesting to me that a journal of conscious aging would include Meg in their publication. And I've been struck lately with the paradox of death. When I read the book, I noticed how it seemed very clear to me that conformity and reaching for the status quo, holding things the way they are, led to constriction and tightness and non-evolution, and that to me was death. And then it occurred to me that, oh, death seems to be a natural part of the cycle of life. In fact, in Time magazine, quite a few issues ago, there was an article, cover article about cancer. I don't know if you saw that, but reading through this article, the author described how cells, each cell in our body is equipped with kind of a self-timing mechanism, that there's a string of chromosomes that will, every time the cell reproduces, they'll lose one. It was described as a bead on a strand. And then the cell will reproduce again and lose another bead on the strand, so that by the time the cell's reproduced a certain number of times, that cell goes away and another one replaces it. In the mechanism of cancer, that self-timing mechanism doesn't work, and the cell keeps reproducing over and over and over again, and the body gets carried away in that way, and it becomes fatal to the organism. So in that way, I was struck with how death is actually a vital part of what we're doing, a vital part of change, a vital part of letting go. And I haven't really sorted through all the parts of that, but another thing that I've done in my own personal journey is I've been an avatar instructor. An avatar is sort of a self-evolvement course that takes a person into a journey of self-awareness that actually brings forward a person's expectations and beliefs so that those are part of their awareness and they're not behind what's going on in their life. As I found out in my avatar experience, it seemed to me that all resistance equaled suffering, that suffering was actually resistance. That resisting death, my resisting death, was actually a part of suffering. Avoidance. In our last session with Margaret Toscano, she talked, actually I guess it was the sexual addiction session we were in, it was brought up that actually avoiding something can be as addicting as constantly trying to get it. And that's apparent with anorexia. But if a person goes through their life avoiding conformity and avoiding any sort of ideas and saying, no, that's not it, that's not what I want, that can be as limiting as any other thing. As I read through this book, one of the subjects that absolutely zinged through me was the idea of information. And I agree with your comments about getting together in a situation like this being so invigorating, so vital to our living, to life. Actually, as we get together, we're not sorting through what the truth is. We're actually creating new truth among ourselves by deliberating on different ideas. And for me, the idea that data, that information, wasn't a hard fact to be discovered, but actually something that was in formation, being created all the time, was something that really made a lot of sense to me. The other thing that really sort of changed my life with this book was the idea of alignment rather than conformity. That with constriction, with the idea of right and wrong, that sort of conformity and that limitation was the thing that was holding back an alignment that could only be made through personal engagement. And I think I really appreciated the way you articulated so many of those ideas. Well, in relationship, I had to, again, think about my relationship to the church. By the time I was through with reading this book, I thought, oh, no, church is doomed. You know? Oh, dear, there isn't much hope about that. And I thought about the limitations, the conformity, the need to agree on what was right and true. And it seems to me that where I've come from that is a place of more compassion towards church leaders in particular with what they have to do. There is a limitation in being black or white, but that limitation is quite cozy. many, many people reach for that limitation and want to feel comfortable in that. And now I think I have the compassionate viewpoint of looking at people who say, who are very opinionated and very rigid in their opinions, as being afraid. And I have a new way to relate to them. My way to relate to them is to be a little bit lighter about the whole thing and not be pushing against them and saying, oh, you have to think about it a different way, but to really tolerate another point of view and to know how that feels, to be comfortable in right and wrong, and it has to be this way or it cannot be this way ever. Also, with relationships, I remember when I was lucky enough, I told you I was the luckiest person in the world, when I was lucky enough to sit down with Meg and talk to her, I said, you know, all these ideas about relationships, does that bring you to a point where you're a little bit more particular about the people with whom you are in relation? And her response to me was very interesting. She said that what she saw now was her wealth of relationships. And that, no, she wasn't more particular, maybe, but that she was able to recognize not what was in that relationship for her, but the way she said it was, I find out new things about myself when I'm in different relationships. And that's been interesting for me. Also, to get back to the idea of creating expectations, I have the expectation now that whomever I'm talking to, that I have something interesting to learn about myself when I find out about that relationship. Also, when I discover what it is I'm resisting about that person. I think it's very interesting what you said about we do want an enemy. You know, we have this natural tendency to want an enemy. And now I look at that natural tendency as sort of an amusement. I find that need in myself to want an enemy. And I think, you know, everybody needs a hobby. I want an enemy. Right, recently I've been finding my enemies on the freeway. Yeah. And that was only after I took lessons from my friend Aaron Silva, who moved from California, and he's found lots of Utah driver enemies. I used to find enemies in television, and that's not very interesting to me anymore, but I look forward to new ways of doing that. Again, I seem to have a lightness about the things that we occupy ourselves with, and the idea of alignment rather than conformity has carried me to a lot of interesting places. Even after we do want an enemy, even with sitting with the special ed teachers and the regular classroom teachers, I found that they did sort of fall to a place where they were comfortable to see an alignment rather than a need to point fingers. Paul, would you like to come up and read your poem now?
Sure.
Great, thank you.
I should say that there may be a phrase or two in this poem that were stolen directly from the book and from people quoted in the book, but now they're part of my poem. So this is called Quantum Theory. Out there, in here, in the universe, matter matters, but maybe not in quite the way we may have thought. Those hottest, farthest stars, these subatomic particles play games of cosmic tag across vast distances. Sometimes the tail wags the dog. Relationships are everything. We all are players in these silent fields of energy. There are no sidelines in the quantum game. observe, relate, or spectate are the same. Philosophers who only wish to taste a metaphysical hors d'oeuvre have stirred the cosmic porridge, changed fate's recipe. Our very being marbles the evolving pattern with a new design. Then space may not be empty. Waves of meaning fill the void and change the face of God. Matter's ID remains unfixed, a packet of potential. It doesn't matter if it's particle or wave or energy. So then are mesons, photons, stars and suns, and you and I, all bundled like a book of matches waiting to be struck. Careening universe begins to look more like a thought than a machine. Thank you.
It's being taped, so.
I'm really intrigued why you're all here, so maybe we'll have time to talk about it. I want to say very briefly that one of the explorations that new science took me into was a much deeper respect of Joseph Smith's great statement, which has been ignored for many years now. I teach them correct principles, and they govern themselves. This is at the heart of new science. And we have gone from seeing the universe as a place of certainty and predictability where very smart people could know it all and make sure the rest of us followed the right rules so we would get the exact results. That's my summary of Newtonian mechanics right there and the politics of it. To understanding that this is a world filled with potential in which order arises spontaneously, as one scientist said, for free. And what science is trying to do now, sometimes in spite of themselves, is understand how this universe works, not from planning and prediction and control, from knowing things ahead of time, but through a spontaneous tendency towards creativity and increasing complexity, and I would say increasing joyfulness. My personal journey into the sciences, I am not a scientist at all, and I offend many scientists. Need to warn you about that. But what was wonderful in this science was understanding, as one other woman commentator wrote, that what we're realizing is that there is just this natural spontaneous movement towards creativity and self-expression everywhere, and that so much of the complexity that we see outside in those mountains, in those trees, in those streams and storms, all that complexity that we see in ants and beehives, it's a good symbol for Utah, that complexity doesn't start because someone sits down with a planner and says, okay, today you will go to station X and you will perform such and such and get this amount produced and then report back whether you met your goals or not. There is, in all of these wonderful insect communities that we're so fond of here, a spontaneous emergence of order because individuals relate to one another, bump up against one another, learn from one another, and somehow have the capacity to create wondrous, complex structures or civilizations at the insect level because they were available to one another, because they became aware of one another, but not because there was an overseer or a supervisor or a church leader. So I want to relate this back to Joseph Smith. One of the great questions that has been answered in chaos science is that order is available for free. You can't predict it. But you can have a high probability of what shape that order will take if you focus on some very simple patterns, and then you combine those simple patterns, which is prescriptive, combine that with individual autonomy. So the question of are we autonomous or are we predetermined was answered in a very satisfying way for me in chaos theory when the answer was yes. It's both. This interaction of patterns or principles combined with individual autonomy is what Joseph Smith saw. I teach them correct principles, or the Doctrine and Covenants. I give to you a pattern in all things. But then it's up to us. Then we take that principle and express it. Chaos science, complexity science, says that if the principles are the right ones and you combine that with personal autonomy, what you will get is a coherent and aligned, a purposeful organization. Not by planning it in ahead of time, not by prescribing individual behavior down to small increments of motion, not by having to think it through ahead of time, but by believing in two things, and this is what I'd love to have a discussion about. The first is that people, as human beings and as maturing spirits, have the capacity to make intelligent decisions for themselves once they know the principles. That's the first element of trust, really trusting one another to be intelligent. The second is believing that order really is available for free. We don't create it. We don't have to make it up. We don't have to think it through ahead of time. This is a universe that has order at its core. It has a desire to order itself. My favorite poet wrote a line. He said, I wait for the shape things want to come as. So let's contrast this with our church experience. This is where we go into Pam's despair, except at the heart of this church and Joseph Smith's vision is a truth that I often quote that line without giving full credit as the best management principle I've ever heard, and I do that in a lot of non-LDS audiences. What would it take to return to a church that understood that its coherence and meaning and purpose would all be fulfilled by enunciating correct principles and then leaving it up to us to decide how we were going to articulate those principles in the moment? If you start to think about this, you end up with a church that feels fairly minimalist, but not like the Unitarians. I actually did a project with the Unitarians, and they were so amorphous that you couldn't find them, and they were so afraid of offending one another that, you know, some believed in Jesus, some didn't believe in Jesus, some believed in God, some didn't believe in God. But it was a community seeking one another through that. But I did have one leader described the Unitarians as God's frozen people because they were so afraid of passion, ideal, you know, forcing an ideology on any one of them, so they just stayed really neutral. That's not what we're talking about. But what would it be like to be in a church that knew that its purpose, mission, desire would be fulfilled by having simple, now I have to underline simple here because the church could go principle crazy, but simple principles, a few principles, perhaps the two commandments that Christ gave us, that might be a good place to start. And of course it's very interesting to watch the movement towards simplicity in from the Old Testament to the New Testament, which has been talked about ad nauseum all my life, but what is it when you go from 10 commandments to two principles? There's a deeper truth in there that human beings, as they mature and become more intelligent, can create orderly societies and interactions with only two principles. So there's an essential simplicity in this new science also, which is you look at something that's complex, but underneath there are just a few simple principles explaining all that interaction. So that is the application that I see of this new awareness of how the universe is organized, how God put it all together or allowed it to come together on its own with some simple starting conditions. Whatever the theological implications of that are, I don't want to talk about. But as an organizational principle or clarity I have, we need to be moving in all of our organizations to what are the simple principles by which we agree to work, the reason we come together. And then I trust you and you trust me to articulate those principles moment to moment in a highly changeable, chaotic world where we can't predict the next crisis. You will articulate the principle differently than I, but as long as the principle is showing up, can be traced back from your behavior, then I know we will have a well-ordered community of saints. It's a very radical vision, but it wasn't in the science first. It really was with Joseph Smith. So I would rather talk with you than talk at you, so I'd be happy to. Okay, why don't we start? Sure.
A tiny correction, because the Unitarians in my community are so ideal to your model. It's only fair to
good, thank you.
Repeat the question so that they know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Hey, there's a place in your book where I wanted more, and that was where you were talking about the organization principles with very few principles and allowing the trust to take over. But as you said, rightly so, history has taught us to not trust. And there's sufficient, I guess, lack of trust in human projects to say, well, but look at the history we have. You know, let's look at the evidence. And so, as I remember, I might be misremembering, but there are many managers who would say, rightly so, if I X, Y, and Z, this could be terrible. I mean, this could end up in a very terrible way. And it seemed to me you went from that into trying to look at the new system of, well, what if we did trust and as you just said, just use the basic principles. I have a hard time balancing between trusting the human project and some and a result that I'm going to feel comfortable with. I guess that's the only way.
And you want me to repeat that?
How can we trust?
Okay. No, it's a great statement, actually. And it is a very common response. I mean, to what extent do we look at our history and decide that we're not trustworthy versus looking at some deep yearning in us and saying, well, I really want to be trusted here. I want my independence and my autonomy. I'm a responsible adult. I think we have, why don't we look at the history of where we have tried to control things and not trust it and where it's gotten us and why we're sitting in this room today, because we're a product of discontent created by a tendency to over-control us, and we know that doesn't feel right. So my model for this is a Latin American business leader called Ricardo Semler, who runs a Brazilian manufacturing concern called Semco, which went from an enormously controlled, traditionally controlled manufacturing plant to one that even blows my circuits because they are so open, violate every rule of standard business practice, and are enormously successful. And someone said, well, why did you make the switch from this traditional financial controls to this openness? And he said, one day we woke up and realized we had adults working for us. Semco. And the book is called Maverick. It's an international bestseller. I think we need to experiment much more with trust. And if we looked at history differently, we could reconstruct it so that it would prove that we're trustworthy.
Also amending that, knowing very well that what I'm not trusting is myself.
Yes. And what kind of situation would you like to be in so you could learn that you were trustworthy to yourself? That's a wonderful way of saying it. It's our experience in large organizations. When you first open it and trust people, they don't trust themselves, having come off of 30, 40, 50 years of being distrusted. Their first reaction is, hey, this isn't my job. That's your job. Or I'm going to screw it up. So we're all in this together, learning that we are greater than we or others thought. Did you want to respond? Because your hand went right up.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. His fear of the trust, I think, goes back to your idea of teaching correct principles, and then we can trust. Teaching correct principles, I think, is more than just a short cognitive statement. It's something that has to be worked out over a long period of time.
Yes, good point.
Maybe that's what free agency and mortality is all about, that we're learning basic principles, and through our experience in life, if we can come out all together agreeing on a 25-word or less statement of what life has been about, then we've learned correct principles, and then we can be trusted.
But to get there, you have to be trusted. That's the paradox.
Well, the left foot and then the right foot.
If someone tries to teach you that or gives you their 25-word summation right now, you won't hear it. You have to be trusted with the experience of experience. Yeah.
Okay. I haven't read the book, but I am a recent convert to Total Quality Management. How does this relate? Is it parallel with it?
This is a question about the strong movement in corporate America for total quality management. Total quality management, as the Japanese initiated it, was all about creating relationships amongst people so they could talk to each other about their work on a continuous basis.
It was an American that taught the
Japanese. Well, I want to just tell you something about Dr. Deming that I love about his work. He started out in a traditional way of saying, here are 14 principles for total quality. He then, as he got older, he just died this past year in his 90s, staying fully active in ways that I can't imagine until the day before his death. He took those 14 principles and said, these 14 principles, he backed up, he said, it's really four areas of profound knowledge. If you understand human change, if you understand human psychology, if you understand how to look at data about manufacturing, etc., then you don't need 14 principles if you have this profound knowledge. And then he backed up one more step, which I only heard from one of his colleagues, who said, everything we're doing about in quality is about the human spirit. So his movement towards this simplicity, for me, was very, very soul-satisfying to observe. Yes?
One of my favorite parts of your book is you describe, because I experienced it too, people in a corporation sitting around with the latest consultant coming in with the latest management fad. They have all these lists up on the wall, which everybody forgets after about a day or two. What do you do when you go in on a consultancy? What's your style? Can you give us a couple of examples of what?
I try to raise confusion to a revered place. I mean that quite seriously. To change our thinking, we need to get off of our certainties. So it's really a higher state to be confused than to be certain at this day and age. Now, I think I only get called into companies where people are already confused. And they are confused and willing to say nothing that we know works anymore. Therefore, how can we think about this differently? Just the old tools don't work. And I want to underline the word tools because it's coming off of this, the world was a machine for 300 years. Now, if we see the world or our organizations as a living system, then, which is a big switch, and it's one that I and my colleagues advocate, if you see an organization as a living system, then everything you do has to involve the whole system. So the major switch, I think, in thinking that my clients is how do we get the whole of the system, whatever the system is that's relevant here, involved in what it is so they can create their own solutions. We can access their intelligence, not ours, in a continuous way, knowing that if they solve this problem, there's going to be 10 more. So how do you get the whole system involved? And there are a lot of people working now in terms of whole systems rather than functions or parts, and that's a big piece of it. I have to say, because my commentators here talked a lot about relationships, that I can't go in anymore, and I hear this from a lot of consultants. You can't go in anymore and say, this is what we're going to do, this is how long it's going to take, and at the end you'll have these results. You can say that, but you're lying. So what a lot of us are doing now is saying, look, I like you, you like me. You trust me. I think we can work together. And let's engage in this process of experimentation and forgiveness and discovery together. And it will grow and evolve into many different kinds of, quote, projects. But at the heart of the consultant relationship now is not a contract, but an emotion, a trust of one another. And that changes the universe. Yes? How does it apply to thinking about the church? Yes.
How do you continue to identify what the church is, the principles of the church, and then continue to respect dialogue from all the membership?
Yes.
Is it possible because of the way the church is set up?
Well, this was identified to me. You know, when you hired at BYU, you have to have a general authority interview. And the general authority that I interviewed, who was a second-tier general authority, very creative, thoughtful person, said that the major, and this wasn't my work at the time, this just came up, he said the major issue for the church right now that they were wrestling with is that as we move into, this is 5 years ago, major population centers of China, Indonesia, Eastern Europe, what is the church? It's not our programs. He said it's a series of principles, and we haven't the faintest idea what those are.
A general authority said.
Yes.
At least they were thinking about wondering what they were.
Absolutely, and I said to him. He's still a GA, actually. Yeah. That's true. Said that that the major challenge was to figure out what the principles of the church were, because we weren't going to export the programs, and that we didn't know how to do that yet. And I said, well, I think that will create a much more liberating church for all of us. And he said, absolutely. Not the tendency of the past 5 years does not reflect that vision clearly, but it is what the church will deal with successfully or fail entirely on.
Do you think that under the hierarchy system of the church, it is possible for this to happen?
I didn't say that.
You should probably repeat that.
Well, I don't want to be misquoted. Now, is it possible to switch to this principle, sort of loose confederation of principle-focused work through the present hierarchy with a prophet making declarations of what the principles are? I actually don't know the answer to that. I'd much rather follow a prophet who is articulating principles rather than programs. And that is what I've always responded to in true church leadership is, But I also want to say, and this goes back to Pam's picking up on information in my understanding of it and in New Science understanding of it. Information is something we constantly create, and we create it out of our relationships. You tell me something, and then I do something with it, and it changes. And I tell, it's the old telephone game that you played as a child. In a church in which information only comes from a few select sources and is supposed to then move through the organization unchanged and immutable and also unquestioned, then all of the dynamic creative possibilities of the universe disappear for me in that vision. Information is not static. So this leads to what you could hear, a very relativistic view of truth. Truth emerges. Truth emerges, and we make it, and we do what we need to do with it, and we create with it. That's not a frightening thought to me, and I don't think it's incredibly humanistic in the wrong ways to say that truth emerges from our relationships. If I, in fact, trust you and we trust the universe, then, of course, truth emerges. It doesn't have to be handed down. The people who have hated my book, and it has not been church people, by the way, but the people who have hated it are fundamentalist Christians, right? Who, this just isn't their view of the world. Now, I've received some remarkable support for what's in the book while I was at BYU, but then I found out they hadn't read it. So, but to their credit, they were you gave $1,000 to the business school, and they gave you a copy of my book. So they didn't know what they were spreading out there. So, no, this is a great question. It's a great question. And I don't know the answer to it. I do have two absolutely conflicting points of view about it. One is that I watch principles emerge when people are in relationship and in conducting commerce together in organizations. They figure out what the principles of interaction are. But I've also seen organizations in which principles are handed down. But then we have to look at what are the principles. And the principles are usually very simple. So they are things like love one another. See, if we could keep the principle simple, I would actually like it if someone would tell me what they were. Because I know that their simplicity would not interfere with my own agency. But it is impossible for us to think as simply as Christ's two principles were. Because we think, well, that's not sufficient. So we'll add a few little riders here and a few clauses here, and pretty soon you get tons and tons of documentation about what the principle means. So I have watched a few leaders in corporations who were very good at articulating very simple principles, and I didn't experience them as patriarchal, even hierarchical. I thought they just created some kind of beacon or magnet. But I also understand that given our traditions, it's very hard for any leader to let go and only focus on those very simple principles. So it is a great question. Thank you, Melissa.
Maybe the answer to that, Melody, could be God teaches principles.
Well, that's what Joseph Smith meant, right? I teach him.
And then the process that you spoke of, God within, which is the greatest and only unifying.
That's right. And I also want to say, as we develop into mature spiritual beings while here, we don't need anyone articulating the principles. I think there's a learning theory, a developmental theory implied in all of this that we can see in the history of God speaking to mankind, humankind, through the ages. I'm surprised mankind came out of my mouth. Oh, back to school here. Yes, in the back.
Lost as to your connection between quantum physics and chaos.
I don't connect them. I kept them quite discreet.
There is a probability that you will be in any given state, but there are basic constraints. So you will end up in a high probability in certain states. And if I transfer that to humanity, that says that there are certain basic things that will constrain our behavior. Chaos is entirely different. Chaos says that the final state is very dependent not on rules and stuff, but on the initial condition.
Right.
Therefore,
that's right.
You can start from an initial condition. You can go anywhere. Now, my particular experience, as I've been a manager of sorts and I've done things of this nature, my experience is that people operate like chaos, not like quantum theory.
Yes.
You appear to be saying that people operate like quantum theory, that they will eventually end up in the right general zone.
No, I'm really solidly in the chaos and complexity sciences now.
I'm a physicist. I haven't read her book, but I can see what part of what she's coming from. She's also saying the observer perturbs the system. You can't separate the observer from the system. That's an extremely important insight. One of the reasons I've come up with this, thinking about this for a number of years, is that the quantum mechanics seem so mysterious to physicists was because they were men, not women. Because they had a mechanistic view of the universe, not a relational view of the universe. My wife told me, she said, "You didn't think I think it's all mysterious because you were mad." No, relate. And I set one of the last seminars that Heisenberg gave when he came to the U.S. He was saying, you know, we're looking at these particles, and it seems like the more particles we look at, we can create more and more particles, but they're not fundamental particles. What is fundamental is relations. That's what's fundamental.
Yes, and that.
So that's where she's coming from.
That is the base from which. Yes, and then when I look now at what's happening in complexity science, it is about creating some initial relationships, the conditions, which are rules, of ways in which vast numbers of individuals in a system will relate to one another. And out of that comes very complex, well-ordered community or society or productivity or however you want to describe it. But I'm finding now in my own work that complexity theory is the most fruitful. From chaos, the sensitive dependence on initial conditions, which says that, you know, you make the slightest change and you can't predict anything at all, it actually did not feel, did not correspond to my experience as a leader or as a manager, that I really didn't have to be as butterfly sensitive as Lorenz and others taught me, that there was something in there deeper, that when you bring people together, bring individuals of a system together with some simple rules of how they will relate, how they will be aware of one another, that you get some incredible diversity and complexity that is well-ordered. I mean, that's actually a tautology right there, but shows a great ability to work well in the world. But it's from some simple rules of connection. The only person who's tried to blend these two that I've seen is Ilya Prigogine, and it's kind of iffy, those two sciences so far.
Going back to one passage of Joseph.
Well, and it's certainly...
You've never heard of the church. I mean, no.
Right. Now, let all speak and let all listen is our rules when we run dialogues. There's this huge effort in corporations right now to run dialogue groups, which is let all speak, but let all listen. We're not there to convince. It's your, well, let's back it up to another, even simpler level. I've given a lot of thought to home and visiting teaching in this area, actually, because it becomes a program that if we could back up to the original principle and just state that. Now, isn't the original principle something like you know, love one another and try and express it this month. You know, try and express your compassion. And then just let us know what you did. You know, so you wouldn't get those phone calls about what are your statistics. And you can do that with every program. There was an original principle that led to a belief that the only way to enact the principle was to teach people a certain way to do it. And that's where we've just gotten crazy. Yes. Exactly. Right. That's right. Wouldn't that be fun? Right. Just think of. Right. What a wonderful community it would to be part of, where you just expected love and compassion from one another. Yes, Doug.
What's the difference then between complexity and the kind of hardening of the doctrinal arteries, or the organizational arteries, or that kind of entropy?
Well, it is entropy, because any system that closes down its boundaries or hardens its arteries dies, because it's not engaged in a vibrant exchange of energy. It's only using up what it has and dying. And we see that in corporate America. I see it all the time. You read about it when you read about General Motors failing, or Sears failing, or an airline going bankrupt, or these great, you know, beacons of corporate excellence, which are crumbling around us right now, became very certain that they had all the information they needed in order to succeed. And they closed themselves off from an exchange of life-giving energy, which was new information, disturbing information. So the only way for any system to stay alive is to somehow walk an edge where it knows who it is, but it's open to new information that may ask it to change who it is. And it's true of us as well. Yes?
Would you find out, for instance, okay, this month you go visit teacher, you want to visit, do what you want to do, we would all just stay home for a month or two and graduate?
Oh, probably 2 years. 2 years vacation.
Would we emerge then? Is that what you see?
Absolutely. It would be voluntary compassion. It's a radical concept. Well, 40 days is a good biblical number. So a little wander in the wilderness. Yes. Well, I have a more hopeful alternative, which is the church grows so large that it can't be managed with tight control. And the feeling of loss of control then, in this is the best case scenario, but the feeling of loss of control goes into a deeper introspective period of then, well, maybe control is not what we need. Maybe order is what we need. Maybe some level of probability is what we need. But we give up, and this is not a false scenario. This is what's happening to a lot of companies. Things have gotten too big, too fast, too chaotic for them to, I mean, they just can't do it with the simple step-by-step pre-planned strategic management anymore. And that's what's moved them. Growth has changed them, not yes.
I think reporting was helpful, determining and reporting was helpful to him, because at the end of the month, whoever hadn't been visited,
sure,
he'd go by and say, see if they needed help.
Right, and measurement is a useful thing, but when it just becomes, well, I got to get out and do it because I've got to keep this statistic up, and there's no heart, then it's when it's meaningless. Yes, this you'll need to be the last question.
Well, in considering the fundamental directive to feed my sheep, and then using the farming metaphor, I think is if the leaders rely on the elders' farm to do that, those sheep are going to be dead. they're going to be frozen. And I think we need to maybe work into this gradually, and perhaps from the followership standpoint, the follower is going to report to the leader what has been done, so to relieve him or her the anxiety of knowing or worrying about
Yes, but it doesn't need to be as gradual as you think looking at it right now. It really, I watch these kinds of profound changes in people's capacity and belief in themselves happen in leaps. You don't see anything happen.